Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this third week in this series. We're focusing on our ongoing challenge, our ongoing crisis, and talking about managing different emotions and how we experience and how we manage them and channel them and so on and so forth. It is getting, sadly and tragically, it is getting harder. As we know, many soldiers were killed yesterday and the day before. The war is getting more dangerous, so it's getting hard, I have to be honest. I'm sure it's that for everyone. But we have to be strong, and we have to keep trying to uplift each other and inspire each other and discuss how we respond. So we've dealt with a number of emotions. We talked about worry a few weeks ago. Last week we talked about fear. We talked about the idea of living with fear and knowing how to manage it. But also from a spiritual perspective, to when we see things that make us fearful, which are the superficial things coming from the media and demonstrations and all the other rubbish that we see, we also need to dig deeper and look at a deeper perspective and a higher perspective and access our emunah, our belief, our deep faith in our destiny, which is permanent, which is eternal, both the people of Israel, the land of Israel, and so on. Today I want to talk about something else, a different emotion. I'm going to link it to another topic. I want to talk about the emotion of hate. I'm not talking about people hating us, that we know they do, but I'm talking about the hate that... Absolutely. But I'm going to talk about the hate that starts to develop within ourselves, actually. And what we do with that, and is that good, and so on and so forth. Hate, anger, which is all normal. But I'm going to connect it to another topic, which is the topic of moral clarity, which I think is important to discuss a little bit. So before I start, I'm going to share with you something I've been doing this last few weeks, and I'll do it today as well, because we have to keep doing this. I just want to share with you something inspiring that I read. Just a beautiful little story. So there's a guy in America, he's a young adult. His name is Alex Cornish. And he was, in one of the states of America. And he was studying in a yeshiva in Israel called Mayanot. It's in Jerusalem. But he'd gone back to America, and because of the war, he was unable to return. So he's studying in a yeshiva in New York called Hadara Torah. I know the yeshiva. Anyway, last Friday, as many of the yeshiva students are doing now, especially around the world, we spoke about this before, for men, we are taught that one of the mitzvot that are really important to engage in, if we can, is the idea of putting on tefillin. So both here in America, around the world, many yeshiva students, on a Friday when they have free time and they're not studying, they go around and people where they are Jewish people, and they offer them to put on tefillin with them. So he went to a park which was near this neighborhood of Crown Heights, which is the sort of the headquarters, the Chabad headquarters in America. And he offered different people to put on tefillin. And then there was a little area there where people were like chess tables, and people were playing chess. And he happens to be a chess champion, this young man. And someone told him that if you go over to that table, there's a Jewish fellow there, he's about to turn 102, maybe he would put on tefillin, or maybe you want to, you know. So he went over to him. His name is, Alex. This young man approached the Jew and said, "Are you Jewish?" So the guy responds, "I used to be." What does that mean, right? So Alex says to him, "Would you like to put on tefillin?" No response. So Alex says to him, "Maybe you'd like to play chess. I'm a chess champion." Oh, he says, "Okay." So he says, "But the deal is like this. If I beat you, you've got to put on tefillin." So he didn't answer. Anyway, they played, and Alex beat him. And as soon as he beat him, the Jew rolled up his sleeve and showed him the number from the concentration camps. And he said that the last time he saw his father was playing chess, and that's why he's into chess. And he said that since then, he didn't want to know anything about Judaism, wasn't interested, never had a bar mitzvah, he wasn't interested in anything. And that's why before he said that he used to be Jewish. But he said, a deal must be respected. Rolled up his sleeves just before his 102nd birthday and put on tefillin for the first time in his life. So there's some amazing things happening, and then the boy was very emotional when he told the story. He said that in last week's parsha we read about Avraham Avinu being circumcised at the age of 99. He said he just did a bar mitzvah for someone at the age of almost 102. But there is, like we said before, I tell a story because there is an amazing awakening of the soul, and people are doing things, and we need to channel that and stay strong with that. Despite the difficulties, despite the tragic stuff that's happening, we need to have that Jewish positive spirit as we've been talking about the last 4 weeks. Okay. So, we're talking about the different feelings that we feel through this time. So some people have shared with me, and I understand it, that, in fact, someone asked me this publicly the other day. I was doing a shiur. I said, what do we do? She said, actually, I'm finding myself getting really angry and starting to really hate. Rage. You read the news, you read what's happening, you feel like almost a rage, right? And they struggle with this. They're saying, is that good? Is that bad? Is rage a good thing? Is hatred a good thing? Right? Can we hate? After all, we're hating an enemy that's really pure evil. So, just as an introduction, as we've been saying the last few weeks, feeling an emotion is always okay. Meaning, it's always normal, whether it's a good emotion or a difficult emotion or a bad emotion. That's not the problem, right? And it's because it's all normal. Like, people hurt us, we get angry. It's the question is, what do we do with that emotion? So it's not about, is it okay to feel that? We all feel that to some degree. And some people are feeling that more often, which is understandable. When you see the leadership of colleges and prestigious colleges, you know, can't even condemn a massacre and quick to call out Israel, obviously you feel angry, right? When you see the spreading of just blatant lies and just unbelievable stuff, right? When you see Jews, unfortunately, the famous Jews, you know, the Finkelstein, the Gabor Mates of the world, who are spreading anti-Semitism and influencing young, uneducated college students to almost support Hamas, you feel angry, right? You feel, when you see governments who can't even vote with Israel. I mean, there's so many governments who voted against Israel the other day in the UN. It's just incredible. So it's very normal. If anyone's feeling hate or anger, perfectly normal. The question is, what do we do with those feelings? Like, what do we do with them? Because we need to do something with our emotions. We can't just let the emotions fester or express themselves, sometimes in a more difficult way, sometimes in an unhealthy way. We need to know, what do we do with those emotions, right? So, I'm going to come back to this, but in order to deal with this, I think we have to go to a different topic, which is also a very important topic during this time. And then we'll come back to those emotions and those feelings that we feel. And hopefully, if I explain it properly, you'll understand the connection. And that's a topic of morality, understanding morality and having moral clarity. Because if there's ever a time that it's so important to develop, to have, to nurture moral clarity, it's now, right? Because things are so confused and people are so confused that we really have to understand moral clarity. Right. When we explore moral clarity correctly, we'll understand and we'll discover that moral clarity involves a couple of things. It involves nuanced thinking, number one, and often it also involves the ability, from a Jewish perspective, to carry contradictory thoughts and feelings in our mind and in our heart at the same time. Okay, you'll see why in a minute. And by the way, that's something that the world finds extremely difficult. Nuanced thinking is almost out the window these days. And certainly this idea of carrying contradictory things at the same time, understanding how they coexist in our minds and in our hearts. So let's break this down. So let's understand the definition of morality, first of all, right? In Judaism, from a Torah perspective, our own perspectives, our intellectual perspectives, or our own feelings and emotions do not create or guide morality. And they don't create a moral code or compass. That's not what creates them. In other words, society does not create morality from a Jewish perspective, right? Rather, we have what's called an essential, absolute morality, right? An intrinsic morality that was given to us. And that's what guides and dictates our thinking and our feelings. In other words, our feelings don't create morality. Morality creates, sure, guides the way we feel, or should guide the way we feel, right? Because We know from a Jewish perspective, we talked about this many times, one of the great foundations of Jewish thinking, which became afterwards the foundation and cornerstone of positive psychology, was this idea that the head guides the heart, right? That although we have instinctive reactions to things and emotions, but we need to be able to guide them through values, and those values live in the mind, and those values are guided by something higher than the mind, which is our absolute morality. Because the concept of, right, that's the first thing. The second thing is that the definition of morality in the world at large, normally, the way society defines morality is that something is immoral if you hurt someone else, and it's moral if you don't hurt someone else. In other words, if I'm not hurting anyone, I can do whatever I want. If I'm hurting someone, that's automatically immoral, right? From a Jewish perspective, obviously it's very bad to hurt other people. That's a given. And kindness and compassion is extremely important, and it's an important part of our moral code. But that's not the definition of morality. Definition of morality in Judaism is essential good and essential bad. It's the difference between good and evil. If something is bad, it's bad whether I'm hurting someone else or not. I can be doing it, or I can be thinking it, or I can engage in it in the four walls of my home, and I don't hurt a single soul, it might still be immoral. Because our moral compass, our moral code, the Torah given to us at Mount Sinai, defines what is good and what is bad. And therefore gives us a moral code, the things that we could be doing in the privacy of our home, which Jewish view, perspective, might consider as bad or immoral, right? So immorality is, and vice versa, as we'll soon see, right? In other words, what I'm trying to describe is the difference between what we call relative morality or absolute morality. Right? Society's morality is a subjective morality, and it's morality which has come and gone and changed and chopped and changed throughout the ages, depending on what society thought and felt. Right? So, I'll give you an example. Under certain Roman regimes in ancient times, it was moral to kill an infant if a girl was born before a boy. Did you know that? Yeah, it's considered immoral. Very distorted way, but it's distorted thinking. But yeah, okay. Nowadays, of course, that's considered terrible. But there are equally terrible things today in society, which I will go into now, which are also considered moral, which is weird, right? It comes and goes. Every generation has a different set of moral codes, depending on how they feel, depending on how society develops, depending on perspectives, depending on education or lack of education, or normal thinking or distorted thinking. That's how morality is created, and therefore changes all the time. In Judaism, it doesn't happen. In Judaism, we have what's called a code of absolute morality, which sometimes is applied differently by the guidance of Judaism and Jewish values in different times differently, but there are absolute moral codes. There's just why, as Rabbi Sachs explains in many places, got a book called Morality. We have that because you cannot have a society develop morality from within the society. It doesn't make any sense. Right? Morality in general is supposed to guide the society, so therefore the society can't be the one creating the morality. It doesn't make any sense. So morality really can only work if you have something coming from the outside, something absolute that comes from a transcendent force, which is outside of the system in order to guide the system. Something, someone, which obviously for us that's God, right, through the Torah, but who looks from a transcendent space inside the society and says, this is why how I want you to act, as I want you to behave, as I want you to experience life. Yeah, are we clear? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, because morality is absolute, and there are absolute moral things, and comes from the outside from a transcendent source, number one, it will not always agree with what we feel. And that's just the way it is, right? We are very limited. We are mortal people. We are very finite people. And there are things in the Torah which everyone will find disturbing sometimes, or maybe doesn't feel right in the context of the way I live and how I live. But that doesn't matter. It's absolute morality. That's the point. Morality is not born out of what you feel. Morality comes from a transcendent source and guides and encourages you how to feel or how to think. Very different. So therefore, morality is not always going to sit well with us if we have an absolute code of morality, number one. And also, because morality is a set of truths, and absolute truths that come from a higher source and a transcendent source, sometimes a few different moral truths come together that contradict each other, that create what we call moral dilemmas, right? Which we have to learn to manage, and we have to learn to bring together. And the only way we can do that is while looking for the divine guidance, which is expressed through the Torah and the Torah's teachings. And that's not always simple. Sometimes it's difficult, right? I'll give you a simple example, right, from general living. So before we get to the big picture, right? You know, often people, I've had discussions with people, unfortunately, at the end of, you know, with end of life issues, right? End of life issues often create real moral dilemmas. Why? Because we know we have the sanctity of life on the one hand, so we preserve life at any cost. We have also the concept of you know, prolonging life and so on. We also have an inability to see someone else suffer. We feel quality of life is not, you know, and it's very complicated. End of life issues are very, very complicated, often, unfortunately. But we have in Judaism a complicated but very clear set of moral codes. There are some things with the different opinions, and you can choose which opinion you want to follow. I'm not going to go into that whole discussion now. It's a very fascinating discussion. But sometimes we just need to do what we need to do, even if it doesn't feel right, because we have to turn to something that's absolute. Otherwise, later on, we feel guilty and we, you know, did I do the right thing? I didn't do the right thing. I find personally, I mean, I've experienced this myself, I find that turning to the absolute moral code that we are given, a godly moral code that we're given that is absolute, is very comforting because you know you did the right thing. I didn't make this up. I didn't make the decision. I relied on God's rules, right? Not always easy, but it creates a certain anchor, creates a certain rightness over wrongness, and it creates a comfort, actually. Right? But it's not easy. We have to explore, we have to come together, and we have to sometimes manage contradictory things coming together. I just mentioned that as an example. It's in its own right, it's a very heavy and complicated discussion, but I want to, yeah. So, what I want to do is, let's just first of all list off. I'm going to share with you five areas where we are clear what the moral perspective is from a Jewish perspective, right? So number one. The first absolute moral value that we have from God, from the Torah, is the love, and maybe we can even call it an obsession with life. Right? That's what Jews are. Our DNA is, we choose life. Life, not only, I don't only mean existence, I mean like life, proper life. We know, I can give you a number of examples where we find this, right? So we know from that, for example, in Jewish law, there are certain mitzvot that are very, very important. And yet Jewish law dictates that you break them and you transgress them, only with the exception of three things, right? You break the entire Torah to do what? To save a life. To save a life for how long? It could be 2 hours. What the Talmud refers to as chayei sha'ah, temporary life. The person's going to die in a couple of days, but I could do something now that will prolong his life or her life for another couple of days, another couple of hours. You break Shabbos. You eat not kosher. Whatever you do, right? And these things are very important from the Torah perspective. But yet, why? Because we have a supreme priority given to life, right? I said this the other night. When Jews get together, what do they say? How do we wish each other when we have a little schnapps with each other, a bit of wine? We say l'chaim. L'chaim means life, right? We celebrate life. I mean, the milestones, right? I mean, the amount of the things we celebrate in Judaism is amazing, right? If a boy, there's a bris. If it's a girl, there's a kiddush. Then there's an upshar, and then there's a mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, right? We're always celebrating life, right? We're always celebrating milestones of life. Because life is of unbelievable importance, the sanctity of life, that combination of soul and body, that combination of just a vibrancy that exists, and a soul and a infusion of godliness that exists within every single person, is just unbelievably holy and unbelievably sanctified, right? Value number one. A second thing that we know that is incredible. Is it a bit hot in here? Yeah. It's almost Celeste, that button at the right hand side, top right hand side. Yeah, that's it. Okay, give it 2 minutes, it'll become cool. In about 10-15 minutes it'll get too cold, let me know, I'll put it off. Okay. The second incredible value in Jewish thinking as a moral value is peace. Shalom. We know the Talmud tells us how the Torah was given to bring peace into the world, to bring oneness, to bring unity, right? The very last, you know, there's the oral Torah is summarized in what we call the Mishnah, right? Mishnah, six orders of the Mishnah, many, many chapters and so on. The last statement of the Mishnah is that God has not found a better vessel for blessing than peace. Peace brings blessing, right? In the Beit HaMikdash, that stood in the temple, that stood in Jerusalem in times of old, which was considered the holiest spot for the Jewish people, and it actually did exist, by the way, it actually was there, and it was on Temple Mount long before anyone else thought of anything else, right? You hear these ridiculous things that, like, the Jews lie, that we used to have a temple on Temple Mount. I mean, it's like, I don't know how people can say these things with a straight face. But anyways, right? So the temple that stood on Temple Mount, there was a whole bunch of laws that were involved on how you build the temple. One was that you could not bring, and it was difficult construction, you could not bring metal instruments onto the Temple Mount area. Why? Because metal, at the end of the day, is an instrument of war. It's the opposite of peace. And the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, was the holiest spot within Judaism, was a place of peace. Right? Was a place of shalom, place of peace. And therefore, you cannot have metal in the construction process on the Temple Mount while it was being there, because peace is such an important value. We talk about Aharon HaKohen, Moses' brother. He's praised in the Mishnah, praised in the Jewish sources. Why? Because he stood for peace. His whole being was about pursuing peace, making peace between husband and wife, making peace between people, between friends and between enemies, etc., etc. Right? So peace is such an admired goal, an admired value. And in fact, the Jewish nation for thousands of years have prayed for the redemption, have prayed for Mashiach to come. What is Mashiach? What is one of the things about the Messianic era that we know that the prophets talk about that will be so important? The famous line, "V'gar ze'ev im keves," that the wolf will lie down with the lamb, which the Rambam explains is a metaphor for peace in the world. Others say it will actually manifest itself literally, that those animals were able to coexist. But it means the nations of the world will get on, there will be peace, there will be the shalom, the concept of shalom, an incredible value within Judaism. So we have life and we have peace. The third value, which is equally important, is the identification and the calling out of evil. Not that there is good and evil, but we have a command, we have a value to call out evil. Even to the point of hating evil. One of the mitzvot we have in the Torah is to remember the nation of Amalek. Right? Amalek, who were brutal and attacked the Jewish people for no reason, unprovoked, when they came out of Egypt, and paved the way for other nations, the Talmud tells us, to attack us and to persecute us. Are known as the nation of absolute evil. And we are commanded, there's a mitzvah in the Torah, which we fulfill, by the way, every year before Purim, by reading a certain passage in the Torah that deals with Amalek. And the mitzvah is, Zachor et asher asalach Amalek. You have to remember what Amalek did. Remember the evil and identify evil. And Kabbalistically, Amalek stands for all kinds of, symbolically stands for all kinds of evil things. They're almost like the embodiment of evil, and we need to remember it because we need to recognize evil. It's one of the values we have. We need to recognize evil. We need to know that there is good and evil in the world. We have to recognize evil, call it out, and even hate it. Now, hating evil doesn't mean to hate people necessarily. Different, right? The Talmud says that if your friend, this is just an expression from the Talmud, that if your friend is transgressing, you should hate him. And the famous book of the Tanya explains, we don't hate people, generally speaking. But you should hate the bad in him. You should hate the evil which he's experiencing, which he's displaying, and try to bring them close, to fix it, to, right? Because evil, so that doesn't always mean, there is certain instances, which I'll just mention. King David did say about certain people who were ultimately evil, like we have some people in previous generation and our generation that are just so evil. And King David did say, Tachlis sinas senesim, I hate them. He didn't say I hate the evil, he said I hate them. Right? Because sometimes a person is so evil that it's okay to hate the person, but even then, we'll talk later, it has to come from a pure place. It has to come, not because I hate the person, but because I hate evil, and therefore because this person is so riddled with evil, I hate them, but it's coming for more from a hate of evil than a hate of a human being. Right? So that's the third thing, the third concept, the third value that I wanted to highlight. Calling out of evil and hating evil. The fourth is the place for war. War is not immoral. War is moral sometimes, when it's necessary. Right? Doesn't mean it's something we enjoy, as I'll soon talk. Right? But war is something that is a moral thing to do. The Torah talks about war. And the Torah says that when we do have to go to war, there's some beautiful verses in the Torah that talk about war and talk about lifting the morale of the soldiers and so on and so forth. And the Torah says that when you will go, when you will be in the land of Eretz Israel, there will be, in the land of Israel, there will be war sometimes. And when you go out to war, al tira, do not be afraid. Have confidence. Al tachbezuv, al tiru, do not fear, do not fall apart, do not become sad. Go with confidence. Right, that's what the Torah says. You know, the Torah says, you know, the people, peace-loving people, all that say war is always a bad thing, that's not true. War is sometimes a good thing, sometimes necessary, and sometimes good. Doesn't mean we enjoy it, doesn't mean we choose it. But it is sometimes a moral thing to do. And we have to be very clear with that. And have confidence in that. Confidence in the morality of the way war is conducted. And the fifth thing is the negative part of hate. That hate generally is a bad thing. Another Torah tells us, "Lo titnas achicha bilvavecha." You cannot hate someone in your heart. We've talked about this many times. To walk around with hate, hate is considered as a very destructive and evil emotion. It's very unhealthy. People who are hateful people are not healthy people. Right? Even sometimes good hate. If you walk around being obsessed with hate, it's normally means you're a very unhealthy person. Because we're just not hateful people. We are people of love. Peace and love. Even though, we said before, sometimes there's a place for some hate, hating evil, intolerance for evil. But again, it always has to come from the right place. And in fact, it's got to come, the only place we have for hating evil is not because we're hateful people. In other words, it's one of these things we have to know where it's coming from. You know, not always we have to ask that question. Like, for example, if someone goes and puts some mezuzah in their door, or lights a Shabbos candle, or I don't know, does a mitzvah, any mitzvah, right? Or gives tzedakah, gives charity, helps another person. You never have to question yourself, where's it coming from? I mean, yeah, it's always good to refine ourselves and to make sure that we're doing things for the right reason. But if someone needs some help, you know, in Bondi Junction, you want to help them, don't stop and say, well, is it coming from my selfishness? Do I want to look good? Do I want to feel good? Or is it real charity? Just go help them. You'll worry about that later, right? And that goes to any mitzvah, like, am I lighting Shabbos candles because I really like Shabbos, or I really feel it's, just do it, right? Judaism is a religion of action. We do the mitzvah and we build the feelings later. However, there are certain times that when we apply a moral value, we actually do need to question ourselves. Like hate, for example. Even when we hate evil, we have to question ourselves, where's it coming from? Is it coming from because I'm a really hateful people, I'm just looking for something to hate, so I found something that's legitimately hateful? Or is it actually coming from a good place? And there's a very interesting verse in Tehillim, right? We're saying a lot of Tehillim now. There's a very interesting verse in Tehillim that says, "Ohavei Hashem soit sinura." Those who love God hate evil. What the depth of that verse is a very important thing. What the depth of the verse is, if you do hate evil, it's got to come not from hate. It's got to come from love of good. You love God so much, you love good so much, you develop an intolerance for bad. It's very different. In other words, my focus is good. My focus is pursuing goodness, pursuing holiness, pursuing morality, pursuing godliness. That's my focus. Because I'm so focused on that, I develop an intolerance for bad because I identify bad and I call it out and I even hate it sometimes, right? It's a very different type of hate. Am I clear? Is that clear? Right? Okay, so we've mentioned, before we go further, let's just summarize. We mentioned five things. An obsession and love of life. Life is such an important thing. Peace is an important thing. Calling out evil is an important value. War, particularly in self-defense areas, is a moral thing to do. We should be confident about that. And hate's a bad thing. So, sometimes bringing, right, they're all absolute elements of morality. Sometimes, when they come together, they create moral dilemmas. And let me give you an example, a biblical example. I mentioned this before, but I'm going to go into it a bit more. There's a famous story in the Chumash with Jacob. Anti-Semitism, by the way, is a number of thousand years old, just in case you're wondering where it comes from. It started with Jacob and Esau, essentially. Okay? And it's the eternal struggle between good and bad. So, Jacob had to run away from Esau, right? Esau was threatening to kill him. He had to run away. Where did he run away to? To his uncle, who later became his father-in-law, the father of Rachel and Leah, and he spent 20 years there. Tough 20 years, very, very tough 20 years. Jacob didn't have it easy. Jacob had a rough life, by the way. A lot you can learn from Jacob. Anyway, but so he spent 20 years there. His father-in-law drove him crazy, promised him Leah as a wife, he promised him Rachel as a wife, then he gave him Leah. Then he had to work another 7 years for Rachel. Then he had another 6 years of employment where his father-in-law kept on changing his wages and threatened him, and it was terrible. Eventually, but he did marry, then he did build a family there, notwithstanding. Another few minutes, we'll put it on. Okay. If you're cold in a few minutes, even with your coat, we'll put it on. Eventually, he's on the way back. Right, I'm just describing, some of you know the story that I mentioned before, but I'll just go through it. He's on the way back, but he's not sure if Esau's calmed down yet after 20 years. So he sends messengers to find out where Esau is holding. They come back and they say, you're in a bit of trouble. Esau actually knows you're coming back. He's got word. He's coming to greet you with 400 soldiers. And that wasn't to have a party. It was to attack Yaakov. Okay. So he panics, understandably so. And he does a couple of things. He decides to send Esau presents. Maybe he'll calm down. He prays. He prays to God. And he prepares for war. He prepares a military strategy. He divides his whole camp. He had a big family with servants and stuff. Maidservants. He divided them all into two just in case one would have to be attacked. The other one could escape. It was a whole strategy that he developed. And then the Pasuk tells us the following. Vayira Yaakov. Yaakov was scared. He was afraid. By Yetzer Lo, he was distressed. Right? So Rashi, the commentator Rashi, brings down the famous Talmudic saying. Why the double expression? What's the difference between afraid and distressed? So Rashi, the famous commentator Rashi says, he was afraid that he might get killed. He was distressed that he might have to kill. Now let's understand this. He was afraid that he might have to kill, and if he had to kill, he would kill. Because in self-defense, if at the end he would be attacked by Esav, the moral thing to do would be to protect himself and his family. As the Talmud says, if someone approaches you to kill, you kill them first. That is the moral thing to do. That is protection of your own life. But he was distressed that he might have to do that. Why was he distressed? So we have two commentaries. Now it's taking a bit deeper. I've shared this before, but not at this level. So I'm a bit of research into the commentators. One commentary says he wasn't really that afraid. He wasn't distressed of having to kill Esav. Esav was out to get him, and he was evil, and he was an enemy. He was pursuing and persecuting him his entire life. What he was afraid was that he might, in the war, kill some of the men with Esav. Sound familiar? Right? Which he would do if he had to. Because that's the tragic price of self-defense. Esav had forced them to come with him. And if he had to, he was distressed about that. Because they were people who maybe did not want to kill him as Esav did. They were less guilty or innocent, perhaps. But controlled by Esav. So what was Yaakov's approach? And this is the moral dilemma. And this is not just the moral dilemma, but it's coming together of different things. A Jew doesn't want to kill. Ever. But sometimes it's the moral thing to do. So Vayira Yaakov was afraid that he might get killed. By Yetzirah, he was distressed that he might have to kill, particularly the people who maybe are not really threatening him. But he might have to do it. And if he has to do it, he will do, because Yaakov was completely in line with God's will. God's will is to protect yourself. God's will is to protect your family. Your land, in the modern sense. And if that's the case, he would have to kill, but he was distressed about it. That's some of the commentaries. The Midrash says a bit differently. The Midrash says he was even distressed at the possibility of having to kill Esav, which was beyond legitimate if Jacob would attack him. The enemy itself, he was still distressed. Why? Because although killing is sometimes extremely moral, right? We never say that there's no room for ever killing someone. There is no. Killing is moral sometimes, like in the case of war. But it goes against our love for life. So you see, there we are. These are the two moral things contradicting each other, right? A dilemma that Jacob was experiencing. A dilemma that we experience. We want to live a moral life. Part of our morality is to love life, any life. Part of morality, however, is to kill an enemy that threatens you. So he would do it. At the end, he didn't need to do it, because that war didn't end up like that. But if he would need to do it, he would do it, but he was still distressed about it. That's how it came together. So I'll share with you something absolutely amazing, where we see this come out so strongly. Jews left Egypt, right? They were persecuted in Egypt for 210 years. Egyptians killed babies. Not so different to Hamas, right? Hated Jews. Eventually had to let them go because, you know, the infrastructure of Egypt fell apart through the plagues and everything like that. So God took us out of Egypt, but they didn't give up. They had a change of heart 3 days in, and they started pursuing the Jewish people. And they came to the Red Sea, and we were trapped, completely trapped. We had the sea in front of us, Pharaoh behind us, pursuing us with whatever was left of his arsenal and his army things, right? It's all biblical stories, just replaying itself, right? Jews panic. God says not to panic. God performs a miracle, hopefully perform a miracle for us too now. But God performs a miracle, and they cross the Red Sea, and then God closes the sea onto the Egyptians, and they drown. Completely okay. They're evil, they're an enemy, they drown. Says the Talmud, at that moment, the angels in heaven, listen to this, the angels in heaven wanted to sing praises for God. Now, who closed the sea on the Egyptians? God. There was his way of protecting us. Let's just drown the enemy. It's time. Right? Eliminate them. God does that, and the angels are really happy, and the angels start to sing praises to God. And God responds, why are you singing praises? Listen to this. God says to the angels, Ma'ase yadai tevuim bayam. My handiwork, things I created, are drowning, and you're singing praises? Now, he drowned them, right? He was the one to close the sea on them. Sorry?
Can you do it again?
That's what you're praying for, yeah. So that our soldiers shouldn't have to die. But God says, no, don't sing praises. Because that's the angels. Because they really weren't part of this whole thing. How about the Jews themselves? Jews themselves did sing a song. Why? They sang a song because they were saved. And when you're saved, you have to celebrate. Celebrate the salvation. Right? And until today, on the seventh day of Pesach, which is the anniversary of the final victory over the Egyptians, we celebrate. We take out a Torah and we read the song that the Jewish people sang. And yet, even us, every seventh day of Pesach, we do something that is reminiscent of God's response to the angels. You know, on Yontif, there's a thing we sing called Hallel. It's part of Tefillah. We only say it on festivals. Chanukah we say it. Sukkot we say it. Pesach we say it. There's a thing called half Hallel, which is like, it's not a complete Hallel. Like, you leave out two paragraphs. On the seventh day of Pesach, notwithstanding it's a Yontif, we say half Hallel. Why do we say half Hallel? Because of that Talmud. Because at the end of the day, we do celebrate, we sing the song, we show gratitude for God for being saved, but we remember at the end of the day that God's handiwork had to be killed for it. And we don't like killing people. We don't like when people die. We like being saved. And if for us to be saved means the enemy has to drown, that's great. And that's the right moral thing to happen. God showed us that. But we still have a half hallel because God had some level of upset that his creations had to be drowned. Even though they were evil. But they chose to be evil. But it was still a creation of God. Right? It's amazing how this all works together, right? So today we have to be very clear and confident about us. We have an army in Israel that does exactly the same thing. And we need to understand this with confidence because we have such bombarding messages saying the opposite. We have to be very, very confident within ourselves and not be proud about it. We have an army that avoids killing. It avoids killing because if they did... this is the stupidity of the world. If our army didn't mind killing people, we didn't need soldiers on the ground altogether. They have a complete capacity to just carpet bomb the whole place, we'll be fine. That's the truth. Why are we sending our soldiers into harm's way? Why is Israel doing that? Because we don't like killing. We're a Jewish army. And a very moral army, by the way. Yeah, of course, we see from time to time there's a soldier here, a soldier there, like in any place. There might be a person here that does the wrong thing. But as a whole, we're an unbelievable army. We don't like killing. So we warn civilians to get out of the way. All this stuff, right? I'm not going into the politics now, but you all know what I'm talking about, right? Because we are people of love. We will kill if we have to. So if the army needs to bomb a Hamas stronghold and they wouldn't let the civilians out of the way, so then the civilians, it's tragic. But the civilians are like, that's moral. That's absolutely moral. But we don't celebrate it. Right? We, in fact, just reflect for a moment of what an incredible nation we are. When terrorists carry out a terrorist attack, they dance in the streets. They give children candies. Do you know that you ever seen people dance when terrorists are killed? No. You say, good on them. Good on the army. Fantastic. We're safe now. When do we celebrate? When one hostage is rescued. Amazing. I don't know if you saw the video that was going on in Israel. Right? We've got over 220 more to come. But one hostage was an amazing celebration erupts. Why? Because we don't celebrate killing even when it's moral. We do it with the greatest of strength and confidence because it's the moral thing to do, but we never celebrate it. What do we celebrate? We celebrate life. We celebrate victory. Please God, very soon, the army, the IDF will be victorious and we'll be safe from this enemy and we'll celebrate. Not celebrate the killing, they will celebrate our victory. Like the Jews did when they came through the Red Sea. They celebrated. They didn't celebrate the Egyptians drowning. They celebrated that they were saved. It's a very different celebration. One hostage is rescued, we celebrate it. We dance in the streets. Amazing what was going on there. Right? We're happy for evil to be eliminated. We want it to be eliminated. But we don't celebrate. We don't dance in the streets when people die. Any person dies. Right? But we will celebrate the victory. So, I guess what I'm trying to go through is that this is how different moral concepts, and that's why moral clarity is so important. And that's why I said in the beginning that moral clarity involves nuanced thinking. Nuanced thinking means you need to know which part is the problem, which part isn't the problem. We have to be clear. We have to get clarity, and we have to learn, which the world finds it very, very difficult. True truth at the same time, that war is moral when it's moral. But killing is always sad. Yaakov, according to the one commentary, even Yaakov was distressed, even having to killing Esav himself. Forget about the innocent people around. According to the Midrash, he distressed even if he had to kill Esav. He didn't want to kill Esav. We don't want to kill anyone. That's sometimes the moral thing to do, but we don't celebrate. We do, but we don't celebrate because our other moral push is love of life, obsession with life, obsession with the sanctity of life, and so on and so forth. So that's just a discussion of morality. Let's bring it back to hate now, right? So we're feeling that surge of hate. We're feeling that surge of anger. Many of us are feeling that, right? So hate generally and anger is generally an unhealthy thing. It's not a healthy emotion, right? But as we said before, hate for the sake of hate is unhealthy, but calling out evil is very important. Hating evil is very important, right? But as I said before, the hating of evil cannot be the foundation of what we are. Is that it's we have to have confidence in fighting evil and self-defense and all of that, but our foundation of how we operate should always be to pursue love and peace, because peace is such an unbelievable value in Torah. If pursuing peace means that when there's no partner for peace and they're threatening us, we have to eliminate them, yes. And we have to even hate them, yes, because we have to be confident about taking them out. Not celebrating it, not enjoying it, but because we have such a love of life. But our foundation is a love of life. Our foundation is love of peace. So confidence to kill, yes, and even hating evil is important. Not necessarily people, but evil. But not because we're hateful people. Understand? If I'll tell you a fascinating thing. Just going back to the Beit HaMikdash, I told you before they couldn't use metal there, right? You know another fascinating thing? You know when the temple, after the Jews came into Israel, after the desert, you know when they were ready to build the temple in King David's time? King David prayed to God, he wanted a temple built. He said, it's not right. I have a palace, I'm living in a beautiful palace, and the Ark of God is still in a temporary dwelling place somewhere. It was in Shiloh, right? It was in the town of Shiloh, there was the tabernacle there, Mishkan, but it was temporary, it was like not a... He says, it's time to build a temple. But God wasn't prepared to build a temple until the whole Israel was taken by the Jewish people, and Jerusalem at that time hadn't yet been conquered. And eventually King David was the warrior. He fought the wars, the holy wars, the good wars. And he made Jerusalem the capital of Israel. And he went and he bought a plot of land. It was a barn that belonged to someone called the Aravna the Yebusite. Right? Just a bit of Jewish history. What was that piece of land? Temple Mount. He bought it. Collected money from all the tribes and bought that plot of land. Right? By the way, just as a side note, it's quite fascinating. There's three places in Israel that were actually, God promised us the whole land, right? There's actually three places in Israel that were actually bought. Did you know that? Like properly bought. And those are the three most contested places in Israel. It's a fascinating thing. Hebron, in Marat HaMachpelah, was bought by Abraham. When Yosef HaTzadik was buried in Shechem, that plot of land where Joseph's tomb is was bought with money, and the Temple Mount. And they're the most three most contested places in Israel. It's like a weird world. Anyways, but the people who were there, who were people who owned them at the time. So the Ephron was the king of Hebron at the time, so he sold Abraham the plot of land, right? Because we hadn't taken possession of Israel yet. Israel was destined to be ours, but at that time there were other people living there, right? Not the Palestinians, it was other people. They were a concoction that came later. But anyways, separate issue, right? King David purchases the land. And he's itching to build a temple. And you know what God tells him? Listen to this, unbelievable. You can't build a temple. You can lay the plans, you can design it with prophecy, you can make everything ready. But it's your son, King Solomon, who's going to build the temple. Why? Because at the end of the day, says God, Dam larov shafachta. You spilt a lot of blood. You're a man of war. Good wars, holy wars, moral law. King David, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayim, King David was one of the most beloved people by God. God loved him always, even told in future generations he makes mention of King David. We call all the kings from the Davidic dynasty, the Malchut David, we call Mashiach Ben David. We pray for the arrival of Ben David. But he couldn't build a temple. The temple had to be a temple of peace. As good and holy as his wars were, they were wars, right? So yes, we have to hate evil, but our foundation, like our temple of our soul has to be love. Hating because we're hateful people is unhealthy. It's not good for us, not physically and not spiritually, right? So we have to be right and we have to be moral, but our foundation has to be love of life and love of peace. So when we find ourselves feeling angry in the emotional sense, hate and anger, which is all legitimate and all normal and all understandable, we have to make sure it doesn't turn into, so this is the question we began with, what do we do with our hate and our anger? So the answer to that question is, after this long-winded discussion, is that hate and anger are a very powerful emotion. But to leave it just to walk around with obsessive hate and anger is not the Jewish way, at the end of the day. Even when it comes to bad and evil. That doesn't take away from the morality of what we have to do. Two different things. It doesn't take away from recognizing evil. They all have to go together. But our foundation cannot be hate. So what do we do with the hate and the anger that we do have? The fact that we have it is normal. In fact, if we wouldn't have it, it'd be a problem. Because of just that's what's going on, I'm just mad. Right? So if we're feeling hateful and we're feeling starting to get angry, so we should. But we have to do something with it. And the hate should actually be channeled into a stronger quest for love and light. In other words, if we really are feeling hate, what we need to do with that hate is, we have to show that we hate evil to such an extent, we're going to increase in love and light. We're going to increase in positivity. And maybe we can increase in positivity and in light more so than we could do without hate, because hate is very powerful. It's a generator which is incredibly powerful. Anger is an incredibly powerful generator. And if we can harness that power of hate and anger towards being even more loving in the Jewish way, in the moral way, in the holy way, even more love and more light, like we've been talking about the last few weeks, that we really need to, and I think today, yesterday, when we see what's happening, we need to step up, we have to ramp up our pursuit of light. We have to ramp up in our pursuit of helping other people that are good to help. We have to pursue and ramp up our desire to pray more, to do another mitzvah, to engage in spirituality, to strengthen our soul, to be positive, to inspire each other, to lift up each other. And if that is driven by the hate, that's the way to do it. Feeling hate, I don't think we can avoid. We're all sensitive people. We see what's going on. We see how the world hates us. So we're angry. So we should be. But we shouldn't let it derail into normal human obsessive and incessant hate and anger, because that's not a good thing. Our foundation is never hate. Our foundation is love. Our foundation is light. The first thing that God created in a dark world was light, because a little bit of light pushes away a lot of darkness, as we know. Right? In other words, if we have hate, what should our response be? To fight it. How do we fight the things that we hate? More light. More positivity. Those that are on the front line that need to kill, they should kill. And it's moral. It's a moral thing to do. And we should support them and be proud of it and speak up when we need to. What would we? Because that's an action thing. That's a behavior. Yaakov had to kill. But as a nation, do we love killing? Absolutely not. Like Yaakov, we learn from Yaakov. He was distressed that he had to kill. So should we be. And so should they be. And they are. That's why they try to avoid it at big costs. But they should do it. We are not in the front line. So what do we do with that hate? We're not taking a gun and shooting anyone. We're not in that position. You definitely shouldn't try that, right? And we are loving people. I mean, just see, for example, you see the difference between, you know, how we demonstrate and other people demonstrate. It's like just unbelievable. You can watch people demonstrate and see the anger in their face. Just angry people. Doesn't matter what they're demonstrating about. And they always seem angry. I don't know why. They're always screaming. We sing. We give speeches. Yes, we call out evil. We say, bring him home. We say Hamas has to be eliminated. True. We call out the atrocities of what happened, and so we should. But we're not angry people. We're not hateful people. But if we feel hate and anger, it's an opportunity. We can take that and we can harness it. The energy of hate, the energy of anger, to want to fight. Fight with what? More positivity. More light. Because we are people of light. We are people that always pursue light and pursue positivity and pursue inspiration. So let's try being more inspired, more connected to spirituality, more connected to prayer, more connected to helping each other, more connected to a mitzvah, and hope God will listen to our prayers very soon. Yeah.
I just want me to read something that Linda Lex actually posted this morning.
Yep.
She's full of light. This month, Sharon Zedek Hospital reported that they broke an all-time record of most babies born in 1 month, 1,823 Jewish babies. I'm Israel.
Beautiful. And that's what we should be doing. As I think I said this last week, I said it somewhere else. It's unbelievable place. Anyway, we should only hear good news. We should keep pursuing light, but have moral clarity at the same time and be proud and confident in our brothers and sisters in Israel. And may God protect them and bring this to an end very quickly.